From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when Tocqueville came to America, not the America he famously wrote about in his two volumes called Democracy in America, published in 1835 and 1840. Rather, let's imagine what Tocqueville would think of America today in 2021, nearly 200 years later. What might he find? Would he be as inspired as he once was when he first wrote about America, quote, "American federalism permits the Union to enjoy the power of a great republic and the security of a small one. Township institutions give the people the taste for freedom and the art of being free," end quote. Tocqueville notes that despite the vast empty spaces of their country, Americans met one another, made decisions together, carried out projects together. Americans were good at democracy because they practiced democracy, he wrote. Well then, how about today? In a new piece for The Atlantic, authors Ann Applebaum and Peter Pomerantsev take a dark view. They write, quote, "In this new wilderness fueled by the internet, democracy is becoming impossible. If one half of the country can't hear the other, then Americans no longer can have shared institutions, apolitical courts, a professional civil service, or a bipartisan foreign policy. We can't compromise. We can't make collective decisions. We can't even agree on what we're deciding. No wonder millions of Americans refuse to accept the results of the most recent presidential election, despite the verdicts of state electoral committees, elected Republican officials, courts, and Congress. We no longer are the America Tocqueville admired, but have become the enfeebled democracy he feared, a place where each person, as Tocqueville warned, is withdrawn and apart, like a stranger to the destiny of all the others. His children and his particular friends form the whole human species for him. As for dwelling with his fellow citizens, he is beside them, but he does not see them. He touches them and does not feel them. He exists only in himself and for himself alone. And if a family still remains for him, one can at least say that he no longer has a native country," end quote. Applebaum and Pomerantsev piece is titled, by the way, "How to Put Out Democracy's Dumpster Fire." Ouch. And it's a timely piece. The University of Rochester's Gretchen Helmke and Randy Stone are leading a series of online seminars on the subject of fading democracy. And it's not simply a look at the United States and its institutions. They aim to look across the globe for the threats to democracy, for the rise of authoritarianism, how to recognize the decline of democracy, and perhaps, what do we do about it? Dr. Gretchen Helmke is a professor of political science at the University of Rochester and co-founder of the Brightline Watch Project. Gretchen, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Dr. Randy Stone, professor of political science at the University of Rochester, director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies. Randy, welcome back to the program. Thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Evan. Good to talk to you.
Professor Stone, when you first reached out to me about this, I was just kind of digging into reading on this very subject here. But this is, clarify for listeners that point, if you could. This is not just a look at this country.
That's right. Well, this series covers a whole series of things. You can find it on our web pages. What we've seen here is a broad decline in indices of democracy across the world, increases of repression, decline in the quality of elections, the independence of courts, and all sorts of institutional measures that are very concerning. So this goes well beyond the United States. But, of course, the United States is both emblematic of the problem, and our domestic politics are an important cause of the problem.
And the series on fading democracy kicks off tomorrow on Thursday. Listeners, we will have a link for you if you want to join these and take in and perhaps learn from our guests about what they're seeing around the world. And Professor Helmke, if you could describe what Bright Line Watch is first and foremost. Can you do that?
Sure. So Brightline Watch is an organization that I formed with three other colleagues at the University of Chicago and at Dartmouth. And it's really focused on trying to monitor the health of U.S. democracy. Three of us actually have our experience in studying Latin America, not American politics. But we were sufficiently alarmed by some of the trends that we were seeing in the 2016 campaign that we decided to form an organization that engages in polling both of experts, so across political scientists in the United States, as well as polling among the public.
So let's kind of just get a broad outlook from both of you, if we could, and then we'll kind of work through some specific questions on the subject of a fading democracy. And listeners can join the conversation if they want. Dr. Helmke, just on the subject of fading democracy, how in the world is it 2021 and what we see is flirtations with authoritarianism and susceptibility to its charms, or maybe the pull of ostensible populism in sort of as a guise for authoritarianism? Why is it that trends are moving in that direction?
I mean, I don't think there is one particular cause that is driving the autocratization. I mean, one of the things that I think scholars have really been focused on is just documenting the trends. So their last week, for example, Freedom House just came out with their latest report, and it was entitled, you know, Democracy Under Siege. There's another organization called Varieties of Democracy that's also really been chronicling this trend in the autocratization of countries around the world. It's alarming. It's also true that where democracy is in decline is where a lot of the world's population lives. So obviously we've seen the U.S. Falling behind in this respect, but we've also seen a lot of problems emerging in very populated countries like Brazil, and India, and Turkey. So this is a problem that is really affecting every region in the globe, and I think it's driven by things like economic inequality. It's driven by polarization. You mentioned, the differences in the information environment and the media. And I think, you know, to some extent, the problems that we've seen really emerge in the last few years in the United States have started to ripple out across the globe as well.
So, Dr. Helmke, while noting that, you know, each case perhaps is different, you did mention economic inequality. Are there cases where we see an erosion of democracy in which economic inequality is not a problem, or is that pretty much a bedrock of these trends?
I think it's a bedrock. You know, if you look at previous periods of history where you had an erosion of democracy or democratic backsliding, a lot of those problems tended to correlate with the overall level of development in a country, so how rich or poor a country is. This particular wave doesn't really correlate well with that, right? The U.S. is the richest country in the world, and yet we're one of the countries that's backsliding. So it seems like, the real problem in the economy is not so much levels of poverty, but really levels of inequality. And inequality is sort of a root cause of polarization, and, you know, the kind of construction of grievances that are getting mobilized, particularly in this country, by the Republican Party.
And before I turn to your colleague, Dr. Helmke, I want to ask you about whether the erosion of democracy is something that populations even sort of notice and acknowledge in real time. I mean, in this country, there's a lot of debate about that, and certainly January 6th crystallized some things for people who are on the fence about whether there was an actual threat to democracy or to fair elections. But I do wonder if some authoritarians are so successful that they can sort of convince populations that what they are supporting is good for them. It is not a fate of democracy. It is some sort of a populist pushback, but it's not an erosion of actual democracy. Do we see that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a really astute observation. Again, you know, contrasting this with earlier periods of history, it was very obvious when democracies collapsed. You know, you had military leaders staging coups, and that was really the end of one regime and the beginning of another regime. And the hallmark of this current period is that it's a very piecemeal, gradual process. It's often, or it's always, really initiated by leaders who were elected in free and fair elections. Oftentimes they are you know, slowly eroding institutions of accountability, both horizontal and vertical accountability, under this guise of reform. You know, not in the United States, but in other countries, leaders who've made these kinds of power grabs have remained incredibly popular. And going on to win election, you know, not through fraud, but winning popular elections over and over again. So I think that's a really important observation to make about this.
Professor Stone, can you give me some of your sort of broad observations on trends as you see them?
Well, I think that this is right. There's a consensus that we're in what's been called a democratic recession. Right? In broad historical sweep, there have been three major waves of democracy historically, one after World War I, one following World War II. The third one started in about 1974, is usually when it's dated, in Portugal. You got democratization in Southern Europe, then in Latin America through the 1980s, and then the fall of communism led to democratization throughout Eastern Europe and most of and some of the former Soviet Union. So that reached its apogee around 2000 or so. So one of these reports that that Professor Helmke noted was noted that this was the first time since 2001 that the majority of countries in the world are not classified as democracies. In the other one, VDEM, noted the Varieties of Democracy democracy report classified 54% of countries as democracy in 2009, but only 49% as democracies in 2019. So this is a significant shift. And it has all sorts of consequences. It has consequences for human rights. It has consequences for international cooperation. It has consequences for international security because democracies are much less likely to fight one another. That's one of the most robust findings in international relations. So the world is a less safe and more more dangerous place.
Well, as I mentioned at the outset, the piece in The Atlantic by Applebaum and Pomerantsev puts some of, at least in this country, some of the blame on the internet. And I don't just mean sort of yelling at the internet and social media, but I mean the actual norms that have changed and what has been replaced, how some of the way we interact with one another has replaced some of the older ways, which is not just nostalgic, but perhaps really deleterious to the effort to build a successful society. And I will quote from their piece now. Quote, "With the wholesale transfer of so much entertainment, social interaction, education, commerce, and politics from the real world to the virtual world, a process recently accelerated by the pandemic, many Americans have come to live in a nightmarish inversion of the Tocquevillian dream, a new sort of wilderness. Many modern Americans now seek camaraderie online in a world defined not by friendship, but by alienation. Instead of participating in civic organizations that give them a sense of community, as well as practical experience in tolerance and consensus building, Americans join internet mobs in which they are submerged in the logic of the crowd, clicking like or share, and then moving on. Instead of entering a real-life public square, they drift anonymously into digital spaces where they rarely meet opponents, and when they do, it is only to vilify them. Reasonable, rational, and nuanced voices are much harder to hear. Radicalization spreads quickly. Americans feel powerless because they are. In this new wilderness, democracy is becoming impossible." End quote. Professor Stone, do you agree with that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, political scientists have been studying what they call the echo chamber effect. So to what extent do we only talk to people who agree with us, only become aware of arguments that have already been vetted so that they're going to fit our political profiles and so forth? And I think the verdict in political science is mixed on that. Some people have found evidence in favor. Other people have found evidence arguing that the internet actually is likely to bring you into contact with people who are more different than your ordinary circles of interaction would. So I think the the verdict is still out on that. But the internet has multiple interesting effects, some of them profoundly democratic and some profoundly undemocratic. I think last time I was talking to you, Alexei Navalny had just been thrown in jail when he returned to Russia. Mm-hmm. His latest expose of corruption in Moscow had 150 million views within 2 days of being released. And he became a political target, for Putin, because he had 6 million followers and was just becoming impossible to ignore. So that was kind of a subversive element that you see in the internet. On the other hand, the news just before we came on mentioned that Russia is putting new restrictions on Twitter. And we've seen China impose very draconian controls over the internet. So the internet provides opportunities, right, that are both friendly and very unfriendly to democracy.
And Professor Helmke, how do you see it?
I think I generally agree with the thesis. I guess I would, push back a little bit and say that I don't think we're at a stage where we can conclude that democracy is impossible. You know, one of the sort of silver linings of the last election is just how many people did end up participating in the election and how many people are, currently fighting for reforms that would make voting more accessible to people. So I think that certainly the internet has played into solidifying cleavages, solidifying this kind of identity politics and these bubbles that we're in. But I don't think that we're at a stage where we can conclude that democracy is impossible.
Let me take a couple of phone calls. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Former New York State Assemblyman Mark John's on with us on line one. Hi, Mark. Nice to hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, great, Evan. Thanks for having the show. Look, I think real reform, which I've been preaching for years, even before I got elected, real reform starts with term limits. And a 12-year term limit is not the panacea for taking care of all the problems. I mean, we need independent redistricting. Why, by the way, as an aside, make sure everybody comes out and votes no, turn the ballot over this November 2nd and vote no on that so-called redistricting reform. We already had redistricting reform back in 2014. There's another push for power, and believe me, it's not good. So as an aside, we need independent redistricting. Vote against that particular amendment on the back of the ballot this year. But term limits are important because a 12-year term limits, that's the gold standard. U.S. senator serves 2 6-year terms, and a congressman or woman would be 6 2-year terms. Because the entrenched power and the money that's behind it controls everything. And by the way, last year in 2020, and this, your guests may realize as well, and your listeners hopefully, Xi Jinping got rid of term limits. What a shock. Oh, Vladimir Putin got rid of term limits. Well, what do you know? And I think Erdogan and Turkey, and I'm sure that Brazil and these other countries will follow suit. Dictators, oligarchs, the people that are in power, the big money that's behind them, they don't want term limits. The lobbyists and the big money want politicians that are bought and paid for to stay bought and paid for. They sure as hell don't want someone like me getting out and pointing what goes on behind the scenes.
Mark, always nice to hear from you. Thank you. And I'll ask our guests. I'll start with Professor Helmke. Number one, if you want to respond to some of what Mark had to say there. And also, Professor, how consistently do we see authoritarians seek to abolish any sort of limitation on length of stay in power?
Sure. Yeah, I'll start with the last question first. I think, the caller is absolutely right. There really has been a pattern, particularly in Latin America, which is the part of the world that I study, where leaders, try to change the constitution to end term limits, oftentimes they end up overshooting that. That happened, for example, in Bolivia last year. But generally, that is a way in which we've seen leaders like Chavez, leaders in Colombia, leaders in other countries throughout the region try to stay in power. I think, though, you know, drawing that analogy with the U.S. Congress, I think that, you know, there are some limits to that, right? I think that there's a big debate among academics about you know, the sort of costs and benefits of term limits. And, you know, one downside of having term limits is that, you know, you don't have people running for re-election, and to the extent that re-election drives some form of accountability, you might get rid of that. Also, having legislatures that are more professional, where legislators are invested in the institution, that's another really important piece of it as well. So I don't think ending term limits is it may ultimately be the right decision, but I don't think that it's all upside.
Randy Stone, what do you think?
Well, I'd agree with that. I mean, that is the consensus, I think, in political science. We have to make a distinction between term limits for leaders and term limits for legislators and other sorts of subnational leaders, which are just very different. A national leader without term limits can entrench themselves to the point where democracy becomes very much at risk. And I think that was foremost in the minds of the America's founders, and of course we didn't get a formalized term limit until after Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You know, but there was an expectation that the president wouldn't be able to be elected indefinitely, and it became a norm after George Washington stepped down. Whereas in legislatures, you know, there are all sorts of other considerations, but the key thing is that you don't have that threat to democracy.
Let me get Jane in Rochester next on the phone. Hi, Jane.
Oh, hi, Evan. You know, I've heard, and probably a lot of people have, that one problem that we've had is we eliminated civics and history and geography, especially civics, from the public education system. And those were courses that I so much enjoyed and wanted more of it. And then you graduate and you go into working for a living, and it seemed to go on. But anyway, what do you think about that? Are we failing our children to even get ground knowledge, be grounded in the basic things of democracy, to know it when we see it and to know when it's not there? I'd like an opinion from the professor, please.
Okay, thank you very much, Jane. Professor Stone?
Well, you know, I have the privilege of teaching at the University of Rochester, and our students just get better and better all the time. They come in so well prepared that I'm a little out of touch with the real world, where students are being less and less well prepared when they come out of high school and know less and less about the world. But it is remarkable. You know, we Americans don't know geography. We don't know very basic facts. If you conduct surveys of the American population, it's really embarrassing how poorly informed the American citizenry is. And I don't think we can put all of the blame on the poor teachers. I mean, they're coping with all the social problems of the country, which are unaddressed by other social institutions, and they're under-resourced and so forth. It's not clear that we can solve this without a more holistic kind of approach. But you know, we know in Rochester that the suburban schools that get resources are great schools, and you know, the schools in the city of Rochester are a disaster. So something needs to be done fundamentally to restructure the American education system. And if the support that Donald Trump was able to get for outlandish ideas and sort of jingoistic policies wasn't a wake-up call about how necessary it is to reform American education, I don't know what could be.
Professor Helmke?
Yeah, I think the caller raises a really interesting point, and I kind of want to connect it to a broader point. You know, I think we're at a time where people are really thinking hard about the quality of our democracy. And Freedom House, the report that we mentioned at the beginning of the program, also Our Common Purpose is a document put together by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Both of these organizations are really calling for a suite of reforms that include things like bolstering civic education, creating forums where people can participate more in discussions about democracy, about institutions, and about specific policies. But, you know, it's not just educating people, right? There's also very, you know, real reforms that need to go on with that need to be followed with respect to our institutions. So in the latest Brightline survey that we just fielded, we asked for expert support, like how the extent to which experts support a range of reforms, including things like multi-member districts, ranked choice voting, and also to come back to an earlier caller's point, putting, you know, term limits on Supreme Court appointees. So there's an idea that this is really, you know, potentially a time for a great number of reforms that might strengthen our democracy.
David emails the program to say, could your guest comment on the role of religion in the decline of democracy? I very much agree that economic inequality is a huge contributor to the rise of authoritarianism, but I think it also likely that more or less fundamentalist religion makes people more susceptible as well. I note that India is becoming Hindu nationalist. Poland's government is leveraging conservative Catholicism in their autocratic moves. The United States has the highest proportion of more or less fundamentalist or conservative Catholic people in the population of the Western world. That is from Dave, writing from Vancouver. Professor Helmke?
Sure. I mean, I guess what I would say, at least with respect to the United States, is that, you know, religion is not really the problem. It's more the sorting of different religious groups into specific parties. So, you know, it's the fact that most of the evangelicals are now supporting the Republican Party as opposed to sort of being distributed across both the Democratic and the Republican Party. And I think it just goes to a deeper point of the fact that we no longer have cross-cutting cleavages, that all of these identities that we have as Americans in terms of our religion, our race, where we live, our level of education, all of these things are kind of getting stacked on to political parties in a way that just really exacerbates polarization.
Okay, and Professor Stone.
Well, it's striking to me that the more deeply committed people become to very fundamentalist versions of whatever their faith is, the more similar they start to behave in political terms. And so that Hindu nationalists and Catholics and American evangelicals don't agree about very much in theological terms, but they all promote sort of xenophobic, jingoistic kinds of authoritarian dare I say, fascist tendencies in domestic political discourse. And so it strikes me, and of course I'm not an expert in religion, that there's something other than religion per se at work here, right? That it's the corruption of religious symbols and rhetorics in the service of something entirely different, which is, you know, political power, us versus them, you know, sort of creating in-groups and out-groups. The current Polish government is a good example, one that has taken a very controversial interpretation of Catholicism, right, and has elevated that to being, you know, sort of the ideology that determines all of its policies, and being very, very concerned about immigration into Poland, when there is virtually no immigration into Poland. Right? It's just an entirely invented issue because it resonates well with uneducated rural people in Poland who have never seen an immigrant in their lives and are afraid that their life might be turned upside down by forces of globalization and so forth.
Talking to Professor Randy Stone, who is the professor of political science at the University of Rochester, the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies, and Professor Gretchen Helmke, professor of political science at U of R, co-founder of the Brightline Watch Project. Professor Stone, can I ask you before our only break, when is the event tomorrow? Fading Democracy, tomorrow, March 11th, what time for the seminar?
It starts at 12 o'clock.
All right, we will. During Connections, you think you're going to come on this program and promote a competitor? No one told me the time. I very much recommend it for listeners. And listeners, we will gladly post links so you can join and follow along with them as they lead off the series of online seminars on Fading Democracy tomorrow afternoon. After our only break, we've got a lot more of your phone calls and feedback for them, and we'll get right to it next. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back here, and let me get back to our phone calls. We've got a lot of them. In Brighton, this is Herman next. Hi, Herman. Go ahead.
Hi. I believe that the greatest threat to democracy is populism and demagoguery, and we need to find a way to educate the voting public about the dangers of populism and to recognize it for what it is. There will always be members of society who will have grievances either justified or imagined. And populists will find a way to tap in to those grievances and to exaggerate them and to get the people riled up, enough voters riled up, and to convince people that they, the demagogue, are the one. If they have just elected, then they can fix it all. And this is, of course, nothing new. Mussolini would be a good example. And as I think it was Dr. Helmke mentioned before, that sometimes these kinds of leaders are initially legitimately elected, and then they grab more and more power. So I would like to have your take on the dangers of populism and demagoguery. How do we protect against it? How do we inoculate more of the voting public not to fall for it, because it is a huge danger?
Well,
and
Herman, I've got to ask you before I let you go, just and try to keep it brief here, but tell me what your definition of populism is.
Well, I can't say it in a succinct way, but some of the symptoms are when the public ends up setting up the populist and worshiping and idolizing the person whom they see as their leader, and kind of blindly following him or her. That would be one of the symptoms, and the populist would be the person who plays into some of the basest prejudices sometimes. Xenophobia it works every time. Racism, anti-Semitism, whatever it is that they can get people sufficiently riled up about to follow them and to vote for them and put them in power.
Okay. Thank you, Herman, very much. Professor Stone, let me start with you. How do you define populism, and do you see it as the threat that Herman does?
Well, I think it is the biggest threat in the United States right now, and I think we see a similar trend in many countries. We see a similar trend in Germany, in the Alternative für Deutschland, which is the sort of neo-fascist right-wing party in Germany now, which, although it's not getting anything like the support of extreme views in the United States. It is represented at every level of German government now. And we see it in governments like Bolsonaro's in Brazil. We see it in Duarte's government in the Philippines, very different social context. This appeal of a powerful individual, right, sort of a cult of personality, as Herman mentioned, a combination of prejudice and racism, sort of an in-group, out-group kind of dynamic, and some sort of simplistic economic explanation. If we just do X, Y, and Z, that'll solve all the problems. Usually the economic policies that are promoted by populists are actually bad for the people who they're trying to attract as voters. They don't really... These people are not sophisticated enough to understand what their economic interests really are in the issues at stake, and so the populists can take advantage of that. And then populism is usually combined with some kind of authoritarian tendencies. And then when you get sort of national populism, then it that becomes fascism.
Yeah, and I guess before I turn it over to Dr. Helmke, Professor Stone, I take Herman's point here, but when you strip what populism is ostensibly meant to do down to its, sort of its essence, it is supposed to be about elevating the voices of the non-elite, of protecting people who've been trampled by entrenched power. That's why it's pretty successful. And it sounds to me like what you're saying is too often it becomes corrupted, and it becomes kind of a Trojan horse for authoritarianism or fascism. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And, the populism originated in the United States as a reform movement, right? And we refer to people like Teddy Roosevelt as a populist because he pioneered antitrust reform and so forth. So it was a movement originally, a kind of grassroots movement to bring back in the interests of ordinary people that were being excluded by elites in Washington. And ironically, at the time, it was associated with free trade, and the elites in Washington were protectionist. Now it tends to be associated with protectionism, and the elites in Washington are free trade, right? But it's a simple kind of doctrine, right? William Jennings Bryan, right, was the standard bearer of the populace, he also argued in the Scopes trial against evolution. Right? It was so there was this sort of simple rural perspective combined with just a few slogans instead of detailed policies and a certain amount of xenophobia.
Dr. Helmke, can there be democratic populism? Can there be populism that doesn't have a streak of authoritarianism?
I think it's very difficult to have that. I mean, the way that I tend to think about populism is that, it's a politician or a political movement who claims to essentially be representing the general will. And anyone who disagrees with this leader or this group of people that support the movement is really, going against the nation. So, a lot of these leaders talk about, the real X, right? The real Americans or the real Argentinians under Juan Perón. So it makes this kind of appeal that doesn't really allow for any kind of debate or disagreement. And debate and disagreement are the heart of democratic government. So I guess I agree with both the caller and with Professor Stone that populism is really antithetical to a vision of competitive rule of law democracy. I guess the other thing that I would add is that society always creates potential would-be autocrats or would-be populists, and I think the key thing to look at is, what are the conditions that make people responsive to these claims? What sorts of grievances do they have that then get picked up and amplified by a populist leader? And then something we haven't really talked about, what makes other elites willing to tolerate this? In some instances, we have parties that are willing to screen out populist leaders. But as we saw with the Republicans in 2015 and 2016, a big part of the problem was that we had no pushback or not enough pushback by elites at the time to screen out someone like Donald Trump from the primaries.
All right, back to the phones we go. Tony in Geneseo next. Go ahead, Tony.
Hi. You know, it's interesting they brought up populism. I wasn't thinking about that, but fear stokes populism, I think. And I think that what we did in the early 2000s in the new American century with the neoconservatives, like when we abrogated the ABM treaty and things like that, we became a foil for all these people in budding democracies. They became very afraid of us. And it stoked, they used that to gain power and keep power. They used fear of us. And so we are largely to blame, I think, because of creating that fear when we really didn't have to. But I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Thank you, Tony. Professor Stone first. Go ahead.
Well, it was a little hard to hear what Tony was saying, but I think what he – it sounded like the main thing he was arguing was that in the early 2000s, you know, in the George W. Bush administration, we took a number of actions that were driven by fear, right, and that this may help to explain why we're where we are now. And if that's what he meant, I would certainly agree with that, that we laid a number of the traps for ourselves that we're currently – struggling to get out of with the war on terror, right, after 9/11, when we overreacted out of a sense that we had a mistaken sense of American invulnerability, and then we overreacted in the other direction and had a mistaken sense of American vulnerability. And then that justified all kinds of policy changes, which led us open to abuse of power in the future. And so the treatment of prisoners of war during or so-called enemy combatants during the war on terror have led to sort of a deterioration of democratic norms in the country. The elements of the Patriot Act, right, which were adopted hastily and in a sense that we had to do something dramatic in order to make ourselves safe, I think made democracy considerably less safe. The wars that we fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, many of the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th are veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they came back broken. They came back not believing in democracy, not believing in themselves. Right? And we never came to grips with the human, emotional, psychological, and physical cost of those conflicts. It's very hard for democracies to fight long, protracted wars, particularly when we don't know why we're doing it, whether there's any point to it. And that's very corrosive of democracy. So then... You know, on top of that, then you had the global financial crisis, right? And this was profoundly disruptive to people's lives, led to a sense of futility and a sense of powerlessness. And then on top of that, you have the rapid change driven by globalization. You know, the pace of economic change that used to take place in a century is now taking place in a decade. What used to happen in a decade is happening in a year. And that pace of change is difficult for individuals to keep up with, right? And it's profoundly destabilizing and causes a lot of personal anxiety. And you put all those things together, it's not surprising that some people are looking for some simple answer that will allow them to go back to a past when they when their town still had a high school team football team, and their store still had customers. Right, and there were still family farms all around, and there were people coming to church. Right, and that rural America is disappearing because of economic change. Right, so people are upset about that. They want to turn the clock back. There isn't any way to turn the clock back, but you put all that together, and it's a powerful political combination.
All right, let me get Robert in Fairport. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm kind of surprised that COVID-19 hasn't come up more often in this discussion because I think we've had a kind of a blueprint for authoritarian leadership throughout COVID-19. I mean, you just literally had somebody on your show, the prior guest, Republican senator in New York State government, saying, oh, yeah, it was fine giving Cuomo emergency powers that have lasted a year where one person can make all kinds of decisions about all kinds of different things. I just think that I haven't heard much about this. I've heard a lot about things that happened 10 or 20 years ago, but not much about this.
Okay, Robert, thank you. I mean, I take the point that a concentration of power in various executives can be dangerous. And certainly if you look at Erdogan, I mean, if we look at Hungary, if we look at a lot of places, I don't know that we're going to look back and think that Andrew Cuomo did the best job during this pandemic. I mean, I think the obvious success stories in this country starts in Washington State, where the first outbreak was, and they are way down the list. I mean, that is an amazing story, and it doesn't get talked about enough. But at the same time, when the governor says, wear a mask, I can't arrest you, no one's going to come to your house and make sure that you're not letting people in for parties, but just try to be nice about it, that doesn't sound as authoritarian. Now, there certainly is an argument that the color-coded zones, he had a lot of power there. Even Democrats are now saying that's too much. I just don't know that it rises to the level, Dr. Helmke, of Erdogan, of Hungary. I mean, I just feel like you can complain about that on its own. I don't think you can say, boy, we've never seen anything like it. We see stuff much worse every day, I would think, Dr. Helmke.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'm really glad the caller brought this up. In that Freedom House report, which I would encourage all of the listeners to take a look at, there really is a fairly extensive discussion about how COVID, particularly in countries that are already, authoritarian or have electoral authoritarian regimes, that COVID really has provided a pretext for a lot of these leaders to garner even more power. So Venezuela, which is a country that is just orders of magnitude more authoritarian than we even have ever approached, there was a movement by the opposition to try to take some power away from the current government, and that's really collapsed under the COVID crisis. And we've seen that elsewhere in Latin America as well. I think the U.S., though, is just qualitatively different and actually a really interesting case. One of the things that the Trump actually got criticized for in his response to COVID was underutilizing his emergency powers, right? So a lot of people at the start of Trump's presidency were worried that there would be some sort of a foreign crisis, some sort of a war or terrorist attack that would allow the president to seize emergency powers. Well, then when COVID came along, he could have done that, but he actually didn't. So he underutilized his powers. I think another way in which COVID just sort of unintentionally has actually helped democracy in the United States is that we actually saw an extension of voting access laws, particularly with the mail-in ballot ballots under COVID. Now, those are being pushed back on, particularly by Republicans in states like Arizona and Georgia. But I think it unleashed a whole series of, reforms to our elections that were actually quite positive.
Down to our last 90 seconds or so, and Professors Helmke and Stone are going to be leading a series of online seminars on fading democracy around the world starting tomorrow at noon, and we will post links for you if you want to take a look, jump on our various platforms, and we will link you up so you can follow along. But in about 30 seconds apiece, Dr. Stone, what do we start doing about all of this? What are some of the obvious remedies?
Well, the key thing is that the United States needs to exert some leadership about democracy around the world. The previous administration made it clear that dictators were welcome, but we weren't sure about leaders of democratic countries. And we weren't sure we were really going to support our allies. I think the Biden administration is returning to sort of the standard tenets of American foreign policy, which is that we work multilaterally, we work through with our allies, we try to support democracy around the world and exert some leadership on behalf of human rights. And I think that will make a huge difference.
Dr. Helmke, 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, I think the main thing that I'm really looking at are some of these reforms that are on the table right now in terms of improving access to voting, ending partisan gerrymandering, things that will really improve the quality of the institutions of democracy in the United States, and really change the incentives of politicians. I think politicians, particularly on the right, have basically been acting according to their political incentives and sort of just following what they perceive of as public opinion and what the base wants. I think there's a real opportunity, though, to alter those incentives through institutional reform. But I also think politicians need to recognize that, they're not just meant to follow public opinion. They're actually meant to influence and lead public opinion. So those are the fundamental changes that I think need to be taking place.
Dr. Helmke, thank you very much for the time. Greatly appreciate your expertise this hour.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Randy Stone, the same, sir. Thank you very much.
Pleasure to be with you, Evan.
From the University of Rochester, both professors leading a discussion on fading democracy. And again, we'll post links for you online. Rob Braden, engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. Julie Williams and Evan Dawson saying thanks. We'll talk to you tomorrow.